Good morning, everybody. It is the 20th of October, 2024, and it is time for Sunday Morning Live. Let's start right off with a question. Thank you for the tip. Remember, now, no question is too big, no tip is too small. I'm counter-signaling my ill temper from last Wednesday. All right. good morning, Stefan and community. First, I need to restock my tip. Sorry for the small donation. I feel what you do here is so important and most helpful to my life and want to exchange it value for value. So I appreciate that. Thank you. Second, I'm not a particularly judging person, but lately I've noticed I'm almost feeling sad for friends and coworkers who are absolutely obsessed with social media platforms or their channels. One person said to me, if you aren't on social media, you do not exist. Why am I judging them? So is that a thing? Is that a thing that people are obsessed with social media channels and following and all that kind of stuff? Interesting. I don't know people in my personal life who are on social media a lot, except for work or business, right? So a friend of mine who runs a big business is on social media, but he's on social media for his business as a whole, not for other reasons. So my daughter doesn't really do social media. My wife certainly doesn't. I don't know. You know, virtual stuff is cool, but virtual stuff is not interactive in the way that face-to-face is, right? Like, there's the number of people who have tried to have complicated conflicts over text is completely mental. By the by, it is completely... Text is fine for, I'm running 15 minutes late, I got stuck in traffic, right? The text is fine for that stuff. Or, do you want to have lunch on Friday? People who try to run conflicts through text, it's incomprehensible. I mean, you need face-to-face, eye-to-eye. The idea that you can run a complicated conflict over text, there's something fundamentally wrong for me, with that whole approach. Because text is like, it's kind of like a last word. I get to say it. I get to hit send and so on, right? It's not interactive, and therefore it's kind of dehumanizing, and it tends to escalate conflict. And of course, you know, people then have evidence, which is fine, but it kind of burns in their brain what someone said. It's right there in text forever, and they can always see it again. And it's, you know, stuff that you say in ill temper, it can be bad enough. But if it's, you know, permanently burned into somebody's retinas over text, oof, that's not good. So, virtual stuff is fine, but it's not a substitute for interaction. And so I would assume that it's a lot of fantasy friends, right? And when you have things that are fantasy, they tend to displace things that are real, right? So there are some, well, I shouldn't say, so there are some fantasies that help you. If you read some fantasy story about a guy being brave and overcoming obstacles, that can help give you the template for being brave and overcoming obstacles and things like that, right? So that can be positive. But fantasy not used as an augment, but rather as a primary, it's like vitamins. I guess vitamins can help some people, but they're not food, right? And so it is something that should augment your progress in the world. It shouldn't be something that substitutes for your progress in the world, right? So if you're maybe a little socially awkward and you do a bunch of stuff with AI, maybe you interact with AI and so on to learn how to begin, then you take that out into the world, right? And the reason you do drills in tennis, right? I used to do endless drills about getting, you know, the top of the serve, getting it angled down and all of that, and backhand, of course, right? In fact, in pickleball, I serve backhand to make sure I strengthen my backhand, but when it comes to doing drills, you do drills in order to play the game. And so if people are in a sense, in this virtual world, and it doesn't augment or support or enhance their actual world experience, it's a bit vampiric, right? And so it is very easy to get into virtual as a substitute for real, rather than something that helps train you for the real. So, I mean, I've made this case for many years that superhero movies, the one thing that seems to be quite in common, that the more you are into superhero movies, the less courageous and effective you tend to be in real life. And that's because the superhero movies are displacing your capacity for courage by making it fantastical and dependent upon impossible powers. So. All right, let's, what else do we have here? I don't really miss being big on social media. All right. Steph, did you see Jordan Peterson get raked over the coals on X? Yeah, I mean, obviously he's susceptible to some criticism, as we all are. All right. The legend, the myth, the philosopher. Good morning, Stefan. Good morning. Thank you for dropping by. Why do women play the don't judge me card? So, everybody who says don't judge me is hiding the effects of their own bad judgment. That's all. You know, anybody who says you're absolutely forbidden to dig in my backyard probably has some bodies buried there. Everybody who's trying to pass a counterfeit note wants you to not put it in the counterfeit detection machine. I get that. Everybody whose worldview is based upon propaganda, prejudice, and bigotry doesn't want science and data and questions and debate. I get that. So when people say, don't judge me, it's because they have judged themselves negatively and want to hide that, which means that they're probably going to continue. Like, judge and prepare to be judged seems reasonable. I mean, we are judged. Whether we like it or not, we're judged. We're judged by our unconscious. We're judged by our conscience. So saying, don't judge me, is saying, don't have a conscience. And it's saying, don't judge me. They're actually talking to their own conscience, which is judging them negatively, right? That's what they're doing. So they're just promising more bad things. All right. Some stuff is useful as a breaking news feed, or say, traffic disruptions will make the bus late. Fine. Or a group will meet up somewhere. Okay. Or organizing a march, etc. Limited use. Yeah, for sure. I mean, for sure, that can be very, very helpful. I still read the news. Not, of course, as much as I used to, but I still read the news. It's important to know what's going on in the world as a whole. And I mean, it is pretty wild to watch what is going on in American politics these days. I mean, it is pretty wild. I am occasionally vaguely tempted, but it's not really my thing anymore. All right, just to let you know, if you're over there on Rumble, I can see your chats. If you want, you are welcome to bring your thoughts to the conversation. And let us get to the recent messages. How's Bitcoin? Ah, that is a fine, fine question. I will get to that for sure. For sure. James did some great research, which I was going to do Friday, but then didn't. Because, right? It's still valid though, right? So, yeah, let's do that. Dear Lord, where did I put it? I feel like I should know. I feel like I should know. I feel like I should know. Hi-ho, the Mario, I feel like I should know. Ah, yes. There we go. Yes, so what is going on with Bitcoin? It still tickles the lower edge of 100 thou in Canadian. So, BlackRock boosts North America's 1.3 trillion inflows. This is from October 17th, so 3 days ago. Blockchain analytics firm Chainalysis revealed on Thursday that North America continues to lead in cryptocurrency market share, driven by institutional momentum, and Bitcoin exchange traded products or ETPs in the US. The region received $1.3 trillion in on-chain value between July 2023 and June 2024, representing 22.5% of global crypto activity. So Chain Analysis wrote, more than ever, North America's crypto climate is marked by substantive institutional momentum. Established legacy financial entities such as Goldman Sachs, Fidelity, and BlackRock, who have shaped financial markets in the US and globally for decades, are now taking serious positions in the crypto space. So did you know that Bitcoin is being adopted faster than the internet was? Right? If you sort of look at the growth of the internet and you look at the growth of Bitcoin, Bitcoin is outstripping the growth of the internet from back in the day. The Chain Analysis added, this marks a critical maturation point for the industry as cryptocurrency is increasingly integrated into the mainstream. Now, Donald Trump is pro-Bitcoin to a large degree, and Kamala Harris has said that she's, you know, relatively pro-Bitcoin. So there doesn't seem to be any imminent political threats at the moment. And one of the things about Bitcoin is it's going to flourish in the presence or absence of political threats, right? So if there are political threats to Bitcoin, then it shows that the government is hostile to property rights, which means that Bitcoin has more value, perhaps. And of course, if it's relatively pro-Bitcoin as just another asset, then it still has valid and value thereby, right? So October 18th, 2 days ago, leading the charge, BlackRock, the world's largest asset manager, snagged $309 million in a single day. So far, BlackRock has seen a total of $22.77 billion in positive inflows, and its IBIT funds holds 380,971 Bitcoin at the time of this writing, October 18th, 2024. ARK invests in 21 shares. ARK B attracted $100.2 million, followed by Grayscale's GBTC with $45.7 million, and Fidelity's FBTC collecting $11.69 million. So they're grabbing a hold of it. Now, one of the reasons that there may be interest in Bitcoin is if you sort of look at the real estate, let's just say real estate in the US, right? None of this is financial advice. I'm not a trained expert. It's all just in my amateur idiot opinion. Do your own research and make your own decisions. I'm just telling you sort of my random thoughts on these matters. So if you look at the forks of the presidential election, right, that's occurring next month. So if Donald Trump gets in and he is going to try to put in policies that will have people who are in America illegally leave the US, right? Voluntary exiting. I mean, will there be some deportations? Sure, but I think he's going to try and put policies in place to discourage people from staying in the US. So if people do leave the US as the result of Trump getting in, who are here in the country illegally, then housing demand goes down. In the short run, right? Housing demand goes down. So housing may not be the best. But it will also deal with problems of inflation and budgetary constraints, right, in America. So it might make bonds slightly more attractive, but it will make housing much less attractive. If Kamala Harris gets in, then the spending will probably continue to increase, in which case real estate might be okay because there'll be more people coming into America. But at least in the short run, real estate might be okay. But it means that inflation is a problem and government bonds become worth less, in my view, over time. So the normal hedges against inflation, which would be some sort of bonds and real estate, it's highly variable. And it does look like Trump is doing fairly well. And Trump's doing well, but it's more that Kamala Harris is just making a lot of unforced errors, in my humble opinion. Don't say to someone who says Jesus is Lord that you're on the wrong rally, right? That's just not a thing that you should do. Now, maybe she didn't hear what he said, in which case she should just come out and apologize. But so I think that's one of the reasons why real estate is probably going to drop in value if Trump gets in the short run, and otherwise there's going to be a lot of inflation. In either way, you need some place to put your money, and it seems like a lot of that is going to go into. So since January, $20 billion US dollars have flowed into Bitcoin. Data from SOSOValue.xyz. Boy, these extensions are getting pretty wild. 458.54 million was added to the 12 Bitcoin ETFs in total, which we talked about this way back in the day about how the ETFs were going to drive the value of Bitcoin up. BlackRock's IBIT led the pack, amassing 393.4 million during the day. And then we went into this kind of stuff. So there's lots of ETF exchange traded funds going into Bitcoin, while Ethereum funds face a day of losses. And October 17th, this is from CryptoQuant data. So Bitcoin prices have jumped by over 5%, reaching a 10-week peak of 67,800 US as demand for the digital asset has climbed steadily. This increased interest comes from spot exchange traded funds and significant Bitcoin accumulation by large investors, commonly known as whales. So, after months of subdued activity, Bitcoin demand is bouncing back. Last week saw a 177,000 Bitcoin rise in monthly demand, the highest since April 2024. The uptick was swiftly followed by a 5% increase in Bitcoin's value, pushing the price to 67.8, a level not seen in over 2 months. So ETFs are the key driver behind the surge in demand, as I talked about in the past. ETFs are helpful because you can then invest in Bitcoin without having to worry about wallets, keys, and losses and so on, right? The US spot ETFs bought up nearly 8,000 Bitcoin in a single day. That's the biggest daily purchase since July. So whales, large investors, excluding exchanges and mining pools, have boosted their holdings to 670,000 Bitcoin, maintaining steady growth year over year. This accumulation has now surpassed its 365-day moving average, signaling a positive outlook for Bitcoin's price, mirroring past bull markets. October, historical Bitcoin rally near U.S. elections. So, sorry, just why would you flip where it is I'm looking? All right. I do think that there is a Bitcoin rally near U.S. elections. Also, in particular, I mean, I know that Donald Trump, it's actually quite funny, Department of Governmental Efficiency, I mean, he's talking about bringing on Elon Musk as the to head the Department of Government Efficiency, which is DOGE, or Doge, which is, I think, a coin that Elon Musk has been quite positive about. So, you know, it's tough. It's really tough to cut government spending, right? So you fire a bunch of government workers, you have to give them severances and packages, and it costs a lot. And then they will go on, a lot of them will go on unemployment or claim disability or something like that. And so it's really tough. It's really tough to cut government spending. I mean, in the long run, right? I mean, everybody knows. I mean, I'm sure the government workers are looking at the 80 to 85% reduction in the Twitter workforce, followed by better Twitter. And that's just a private company. So I assume that people are looking. And, it, you know, when you look at the wide variance in the policies between Trump and Harris, then you just get a sense of the instability of the system, like it's going to go one direction or perhaps in a fairly different direction. And that variability in the system means that there's unpredictability in its core. And because where there's unpredictability in its core, a lot of people view Bitcoin as more valuable, more predictable, because it's not subject to human whim and manipulation, right? At least not in the same way that fiat currency is. Banking giant Standard Chartered has issued a report forecasting a potential surge in Bitcoin's value. Jeff Kendrick, the bank's global head of digital assets research, anticipates that Bitcoin could near its record high of 73.8 in the weeks preceding the U.S. presidential election. In a note released on Tuesday, Kendrick attributed Bitcoin's recent upward trend to several contributing factors. He stated, quote, "For Bitcoin, the combined factors mean a bleed up towards the all-time high of 73.8 looks likely pre-election." Key factors driving this trend, according to Kendrick, include the steepening U.S. Treasury yield curve, renewed interest in spot Bitcoin exchange-traded funds, and Donald Trump's improving election odds. Kendrick also highlighted the increased institutional involvement, including significant inflows into spot Bitcoin ETFs and rising interest in Bitcoin call options. He noted growing activity around the 80,000 strike price for Bitcoin call options expiring on December 27th on the Deribit exchange. Another 1,500 Bitcoin was added to the open interest at the 80,000 call in the past week. So this is growing confidence in a significant price rise. QCP Capital analysts have noticed a significant rise in Bitcoin, comparing it to similar patterns seen before in past U.S. elections. Their latest report delves into the influence of historical price movements, current market dynamics, and upcoming events on the cryptocurrency's future course. So, could be to do with that. So, is the election going to shift the market? This is from Mining News. With Bitcoin prices on the rise in October, miners are seeing a bit more cash in their pockets compared to the start of the month. The network's hash price, which represents the value of one petahash per second, has climbed by over 14% this month. So, that seems good. So, miners are having an easier way. There's a Falcon X platform can transform how miners liquidate crypto. Falcon X, a digital assets prime brokerage firm, has launched a platform that automates the conversion of cryptocurrency to US dollars for miners. This platform aims to streamline the liquidation process, reducing delays and improving efficiency for miners. A Zimbabwean professor, let's jump around a little bit, this is from October 16th, a Zimbabwean professor has highlighted the BRICS New Development Fund as a crucial alternative to the IMF, offering better financial terms to developing nations. He emphasized the NDBs, this New Development Bank role in helping countries like Zimbabwe escape debt cycles, and discussed the introduction of Zimbabwe gold, a currency backed by mineral wealth, as part of a broader economic strategy. So if people are moving away from IMF, if they're moving away from the US dollar, then I think that certainly means that if demand for the US dollar goes down, then the price of Bitcoin goes up relative to the US dollar because its value could go down. Because of that, Brazil is also pushing a shift away from the US dollar within the BRICS alliance, advocating for more use of national currencies in trade among member countries. So that's important. Tesla has relocated $760 million worth of Bitcoin while SpaceX funds remain untouched. That's from October 15th. On October 15th, Tesla initiated a transaction transferring 1,800 Bitcoin at precisely 5:03 p.m. Eastern. At block height, blah, 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 blah. Following this initial move, the company shifted a grand total of 11,509 Bitcoin, valued at more than $760 million from its well-known wallets. At this time, it's suspected that the funds have been relocated to new wallets, although this remains unconfirmed. More companies are following a Bitcoin-first strategy, aiming to issue debt to acquire digital gold, the Bitcoin, right? So this is sort of the MicroStrategy asset. PayPal has expanded its crypto reach. 60 million Venmo users are now linked to MoonPay. Payment giant PayPal announced on Thursday that Venmo is now available as a payment option for MoonPay users in the US. PayPal, which owns Venmo, is expanding its integration with MoonPay, allowing users to fund their MoonPay accounts using Venmo balances, linked bank accounts, credit cards, or debit cards through Venmo. PayPal stated, "Now Venmo's more than 60 million monthly active users can seamlessly fund transactions on the MoonPay platform using their Venmo balance or linked bank account, credit card, or debit card in Venmo." So that gets people into the digital world, and that seems important. So MoonPay is a multinational financial technology company involved in the transfer of cryptocurrency, founded by blah, blah, blah. In 2019, the company is based in Miami, provides payment infrastructure for cryptocurrency and non-fungible tokens to be bought and sold with fiat currencies. So I guess it's a gateway to buy and sell other cryptos, of which I assume it would be fairly significant for there to be Bitcoin in that process. All right, that was a long, convoluted way of saying something, but there it is. So there's our update. Thank you for the tip. Let's see here. Let's get to your questions. So there's your house Bitcoin. Steph, have you seen all the X posts from women claiming men's loneliness is their problem? Right. So a man's weakness is often status, and a woman's weakness is often vanity. You're strong, empowered, and you're glorious, and the world should bow before you, and you don't need men, and right, all of that. Especially a young, attractive woman, the vanity potential is enormous. So it is really chilling at the moment to see, and I've talked about this in a recent show, so I won't get into great detail here, but it is really chilling to see just how cold a lot of women are towards men. Now, remember, please, my friends, social media is not real life, right? Social media is not real life. So one of the problems with social media is it exposes you to sometimes the worst elements of humanity who tend to post the most. And so it gives you a skewed perception of the amount of dysfunction in the world. So yeah, there are a lot of cold women who say, well, you know, if a woman's lonely, it's because a man isn't stepping up and it's his fault. And if a man's lonely, it's because he's an incel loser with small penis energy, and it's also his own fault, right? Now, look, that is cold, that is cruel, that is mean, but that's not women, right? That's a percentage of women. It's not a very large percentage of women who are that aggressive, right? Who are that aggressive. And of course, the fact that women vote through the power of the state to take resources from men means, like, whoever you exploit, you have to dehumanize. You cannot have empathy for whoever you're exploiting. The master cannot have empathy for the slaves. He cannot have slaves if he has empathy for the slaves. So what happens is, in the sense, the devil tempts you into wanting things for free that comes at the expense of others. And then you get some free stuff, but you lose your soul because women as a whole often vote to exploit men through the state, right? They get more out of the state than they pay in, which means the deficit is paid for by men. And whoever you exploit, you have to dehumanize. And this is common wherever women vote, right? I mean, I'm not against women voting, right? I'm against the use of coercion to solve complicated social problems as a whole. But what is in common is that women vote to take away resources from men. And then women end up dehumanizing men and not recognizing male concerns as legitimate. And that's because when you exploit someone, you have to dehumanize them. So feminism is the necessary ideology of dehumanizing men in order for pure material greed to exploit the productivity of men. So this is why a lot of men are going on strike these days, right? But again, that's not the majority of women. I mean, there's this really terrible, it's a really terrible, you know, the dog in hell, like the dog, this is fine with the cup, right? So there's a woman and society's burning down and she says, but abortion, right? And that is cold, man. That is cold. Do you keep in touch with any other content creators? No. No. Now, we do see, of course, that there's a fairly consistent movement among women in their 30s to shame and humiliate men who want to date, older men who want to date women in their 20s. It actually seems to be the case that having a younger wife extends a man's lifespan. Having a younger wife, and there could be any number of reasons for that, but having a younger wife tends to have a protective element on mortality for men. So the women are outraged that a 40-year-old man would want to date a 25-year-old woman, and then, you know, likens that to, you know, interest in children, which is, of course, false and gross. But, and I understand that. That's, you know, I mean, if I was a 35-year-old woman, I wouldn't want to compete with a 25-year-old woman either. I get that. I get that. So, but because you can't move back time when you've screwed up through misuse of time, all that's left is aggression and gaslighting, right? You can't turn back the clock, right? You can't. If you are a woman and you've messed up, you know, 18 to 35, right? For 17 years. So you've messed up 17 years and you're single and you've obviously, I assume, had a lot of relationships. You may have even had an abortion or two, and you're aging out. Well, because you can't turn back the clock, what can you do? How can you compete with the 25-year-old who's, you know, maybe less bitter, has had fewer partners, and so on. How, you know, because, I mean, when you're young, and I get this, life seems to be a lot about money. When you get older, you realize that life is really about your relationships, right? Life is really about your relationships. Money can't listen to you. Money can't hug you. Money can't hold your hand and tell you everything's going to be okay, right? Money can't have sex with you. You know, money can't love you. It's inhuman, right? It's a reflection of human saving, but it's fundamentally, it's not human. I mean, the most common virtual relationship people have is not with social media, but with money. And if women have made the mistake, which is common, of thinking that what they find attractive in a man will be what a man finds attractive in them, right? So they say, well, I want a man who's hard-driving and a go-getter and aggressive and makes a lot of money. So then they go and do that, thinking that a man will find that attractive. But in general, we don't care. In fact, your career is probably a negative to us because it means that you're less likely to raise our kids. And if the woman is working and the man is working, strangers are raising the kids, everything's stressful, everything's expensive, and parenting is no fun. I mean, one of the reasons for the falling birth rate is the two-parent income family, which is not required by anything other than substantive greed. You know, people say, oh, yes, but you need a two-parent household to make ends meet these days. It's like, no, the current generation is still wealthier than all but one or two of every single generation in the past, right? So it's not that you have to. It's just that if you want all of these trinkets and toys and nonsense and big houses and expensive cars and all of that stuff, just get a bike or take the bus, for God's sakes, or move further out and find some other way to make money, or, you know, there's lots of different options. But a man looks at a working woman and says, so neither of us are going to raise our kids, and you're not going to want to give up your career, and if you do, you'll be dissatisfied. So it's just a recipe for stress and unhappiness. And of course, another reason why the birth rate is falling is we've had a generation, and you can't just erase these memories. We have a generation now that has grown up, and did they watch their parents have fun as parents? Did they watch their parents enjoy parenting or not? Right? Did they watch their parents enjoy parenting or not? And if your parents didn't seem to have fun parenting, you know, if they fought, if there was stress and tension and unhappiness and worry and there was never any time and everybody was overwhelmed, like, you don't want to do that, right? The way you sell family to your kids is enjoy your family life. But, and in particular, like, if a woman can't pull a long-term husband and boyfriend out of university, I don't know what they're doing. I mean, you have young, single guys, and some of them may have these sort of high school long-distance relationships, but they're fairly easy to displace. So you have young, single guys, you know, relatively high IQ, ambitious, willing to defer gratification, and I don't know. I mean, if you can't get a husband out of university, good luck afterwards. All right. Will you or have you done a truth about the Founding Fathers? I'm so grateful for the Bill of Rights, evermore in these uncertain times, as it makes it clear what we may or may not be losing. I've not done the truth about the Founding Fathers. I have not done that. What is wild to think of is the fates of the Founding Fathers was wild. I mean, you think that it's tough being a truth teller now. What happened to the Founding Fathers, most of them, was just wild. Okay, I can't go to left-wing sites because they'll just talk about colonialists and slave owners and so on, right? But the Founding Fathers is wild because they were, like, unbelievably persecuted. They were unbelievably persecuted. So they did work very hard. And what happened? Those who led the effort to step up and break away from King George would face serious consequences, not just the vengeance of the British throne, but their unwavering commitment to the cause of freedom would come at high personal price as well. So what happened to the fate of the number of the signers of the Declaration of Independence? George Walton of Georgia was wounded and captured in 1778, leading his state's militia in the defense of his hometown of Savannah. 30-year-old Thomas Hayward Jr. of South Carolina signed the declaration at the great displeasure of his father, who was sympathetic to the king, and told Thomas he would likely hang for the act. The two men resolved their differences before the elder Hayward died the next year. 2 years later, Thomas, along with fellow South Carolina signers Edward Rutledge and Arthur Middleton, was taken prisoner at the Siege of Charlottetown and held nearly a year to the war's end. Richard Stockton of New Jersey had his home overrun by the British invasion. He managed to get his family to safety, but he was captured specifically because he signed the Declaration of Independence. He remained imprisoned for years, the last half year of which he nearly starved and froze to death. In battered health, he was released and returned to his home to find that his furniture, all of his furniture, crops, and livestock were taken or destroyed, and his library, one of the colony's best, was burned. John Witherspoon of New Jersey, an active clergyman and president of the College of New Jersey, later to become Princeton, shut down and evacuated the school when British troops invaded the area. He spent most of the rest of his life rebuilding the college. Witherspoon also lost his son James in the Battle of Germantown. Thomas McCain of Delaware led an army the day after signing the Declaration to help George Washington in the defense of New York City and narrowly escaped with his life from cannon fire. In the next year, he was on the run from the British, having to move his family 5 times. Now, this is the guy I always remember. John Hart of New Jersey was also pursued by the British. His property was invaded and looted. Two of his young children fled to relatives' homes nearby, and Hart himself took refuge where he could in the surrounding woods and in nearby caves. He returned to his home a few months later, and a few years after that, he offered the field surrounding his property as an encampment to Washington and 12,000 troops. Lewis Morris of New York lost almost all of his property and wealth in the war, much of it within just 2 months of signing the Declaration of Independence. He served as a brigadier general during the war and spent nearly all his post-war days working to rebuild his property and farmlands. His frail wife was imprisoned by the British and never recovered her health. Philip Livingston of New York was forced from residence to residence by the British armies. His first two homes became a British barracks and hospital, and the other two homes were burnt to the ground. In addition to the properties he lost to the enemy, he sold several others to support the colonial war effort and died suddenly in 1778 before he could rebuild. Lyman Hall, on the advice of General Washington, took his wife and son and fled his Georgia home for Connecticut, where he remained for 2 years until the war's end. He returned to his property in Georgia, but had lost most of what he had. So, Robert Morris of Pennsylvania surpassed all when it came to putting up his personal fortunes to support the war effort. Before any country or major bank was willing to extend credit to the fledgling U.S., Morris was there. The $10,000 that he loaned the new government supplied Washington's desperate troops, who went on to defeat the British at Trenton. Like Braxton, he also supported the shipping industry that delivered provisions to the soldiers and citizens. Morris never recovered his pre-war wealth, but his investment helped to turn the tide of war in favor of the Americans and helped establish the United States as a nation. So, yeah, I mean, they hid in the woods, pursued, attacked, imprisoned, just wild. So, yeah, I mean, and of course, as a lot of them were Christians, and Christians, of course, are fully aware that to be virtuous is to be persecuted, right? To be virtuous is to be persecuted. And it is the way of the world. It is the way of the world. I wonder if the Bitcoin price will drop if Trump wins. It did last time he won. Him winning could increase opportunities for other investments that are too risky under Kamala. Yeah. I mean, nobody knows the future, of course, right? Had a great chat with the call in AI, A++. Oh, good. Fantastic. Good to hear. This is another benefit. If you're listening to this and you subscribe to the show, you get access to some amazing AIs. On one side, if Trump wins, Bitcoin should surge because he's friendly to crypto. On the other hand, government spending and inflation would go down dramatically, making the dollar better for longer. There's not much they can do really about inflation at the moment, in my opinion. It's just too big. Has anything in watching Bitcoin's growth surprised you? I'm kind of surprised it's still around. 7 transactions per second. I said from the very beginning that Bitcoin was unlikely to be a buy coffee situation. It is, I said the Bitcoin is its greatest value in business-to-business transactions, not business-to-consumer transactions. So business, and I just happen to be annoyingly knowledgeable about this just because I was a business, I never sold to the consumer. In my software company, we never sold to the consumer, we sold to the businesses. So I just became aware of this giant swath of the what's called the B2B economy, right? So the B2B economy, what is the, I remember this from the past, what is the size of the B2B economy? So 2024, what do we got here? Oh, that's just the software side. Oh, well, that's a report to buy. It's huge. Like, it's absolutely shocking. And of course, if you just go and buy stuff and you don't work in the B2B, if you don't work in the B2B sphere, you don't really know just how enormous it is, right? Let's see here. The B2B economy, was it like 20 trillion? It's huge. And it's forecasted to grow enormously. So the B2B economy is huge. And the one thing I know for sure about the B2B economy is that it's slow to settle. Right. I mean, we would sometimes have to wait in my business. We would sometimes have to wait 90 days to get paid. I mean, it was pretty exciting because cash flow is king in business. You've always got to pay your payroll and your rent, and right? But sometimes it takes quite a long time to get paid, right? So when we had in the business world, when we had a 90-day payment system, and you know, sometimes we would try to do it better, but if you've got a 90-day close, let's say it takes a couple of hours for your Bitcoin to settle, but that doesn't help you at Starbucks, but it absolutely matters. It's irrelevant to business transactions for the most part, right? I mean, if you think of how long it takes to buy a house, right? Like you escrow and all of that. And so if you you recognize that, and if you say, well, but Bitcoin, it might take an hour or two to settle, is that a very important thing? Is that, it's so funny because the B2B, they're all talking, it's all about e-commerce, right? It's all about e-commerce. Yeah, digital. So yeah, I mean, so the B2B is huge, right? B2B is huge. And I had, of course, lots of conversations with people. I remember talking to a guy who, they were just-in-time manufacturing. And he said, it's really stressful because just-in-time manufacturing is, you know, only deliver the parts when the car, say, is about to be assembled. And like they reach for it and it's got to be in your hand when you reach for it, not a moment too soon, not a moment too late. Because if you send it too soon, it's expensive to store the parts. And if you send it too late, it slows down production. So it's the timing is just incredible. So when you look and say, well, Bitcoin is slow, okay, but there's lots of massive transactions in the economy that are very slow. Again, buy a house, even buying a car can take a while, right? You got to sign a lot of paperwork and so on. And you go see a bunch of cars. So let's say it takes a couple of hours to close. Well, that's fine, right? You will start the close, do the paperwork, and then it's all done, right? So, and B2B, again, anything less than 90 days is a big step in the right direction. So, oh, that's nice. He's asking me if I want something. So, yeah, the fact that it's slow is only of relevance to consumers. It's far. And imagine this. So imagine that Bitcoin is your retirement savings strategy, right? Right. Let's say that Bitcoin is your retirement savings strategy. Do you care if it takes a couple of hours to sell? Right. If you could save $2 million in Bitcoin for your retirement, does it matter to you that? So if you're buying and holding something for 5 years, so you're a 5-year bond or whatever, I mean, it's very slow transactions. So the fact that it's not ideal for buying a coffee, I mean, I'm not saying that's unimportant, of course, right? But it's not foundational to how I see the value of it working, which is a savings, an investment, and a B2B scheme or system. So again, I've said some of this stuff in the past, right? But it's worth revisiting because, you know, shockingly, not everyone has listened to everything, right? So no, it hasn't surprised me. All right. Well, you know, it's always the question around politics that the elites, they want more power, but they don't necessarily want to kill the goose that lays the golden egg, right? So the elites want more power. So the farmer wants his cows in the smallest enclosure possible that isn't going to kill them. Right. So let's say that you're grass, you do grass fed, right? And let's say it's honorable grass fed, not these like buckets of hay. So you want, let's say you're free range chickens, right? They actually out there doing their thing. So you don't want to put them on, you don't want to put, you know, 100 chickens on 100 acres, right? That's too big, right? At the same time, you don't want to put them in a little cardboard box because that's going to kill them. So you want to shrink the land that your livestock is on until they start to no longer, like they're too stressed, they're not producing any milk, and then you'll expand it a little. So you want to, so this is the way sort of I view these things. Now, there are some people who are just completely addicted to power and so on, but are the powers that be, are they concerned that their income is going to be diminished if too much government control hits the economy, right? And will they make it so that the government control goes down, right? Steph, what are you looking forward to? Well, I mean, it may sound trite, but I look forward to every day. I look forward to these conversations. I look forward to time with my family. I look forward to exercise to a large degree. I certainly look forward to sports, and I look forward to continue doing the great work that I'm doing. I've really, and I talked about this in a show this morning, but it really did. A friend of mine had a very large tragedy in his family this week, and the transitory nature of life gets more and more impressed upon you as you age. And I am so deeply and immensely grateful for what you guys do, for what the technology of the world has allowed us to do. And I feel like almost like a disposable flesh puppet for eternal virtues. I feel like infinity, eternity, universality, and morality have kind of jabbed their fingers up my spine and used me to speak essential truths before I will be discarded in the flesh heap of inevitable mortal history. And that I am a passing thing, but what we talk about here, as best as I can, will deeply root to the eternal and the true. When you get to my age, right, so I'm 58. A lot of people have kids late 20s, early 30s. So 58 plus 30 is 88. So, you know, my friend's parents are aging out. And it gives you a real perspective on what's important in life. You know, as they say, if you have your health, you have everything. And some of the older people are aging out in really tragic ways. I mean, losing mental faculties, losing bodily functions and autonomy. You know, this wind down is hard to see. And it's hard to see because if you're lucky, it's coming to you, right? If you're lucky, you don't get hit by a bus when you're 40, right? If you're lucky. Do you ever have a toy when you were a kid, like a wind-up toy? Most of us had a wind-up toy, right? So I would do this thing where I would wind up the toy to its maximum, right? And then, right, it would do its little stompy or whatever, like it would do its little, and then it would just kind of wind down. But the wind down of the human animal sheds memories, sorrow, mortality, depth. You know, I wrote the deathbed scenes in my novel, The Future, also based upon what I had seen from people I know whose parents are aging out. You know, it's coming, man. There's no escaping it at all. And your best chance is a slow decay. And it lands like an absolute fiery comet in the lives of younger people. Right? The kids, the grandkids, maybe the great-grandkids. It is a comet that lays waste to the city of predictability. And I do feel that when I sit down to have these conversations, that if I allow the passage of eternity through my vocal cords, then it is the best service of whatever is occurring within me to humanity as a whole. You know, somebody, and I do get these messages, and I really do appreciate them. People say, well, thank you, you saved my life, or thank you. And listen, I really appreciate that. But I can't take much credit. I can take credit for some courage, some focus, some, you know, steadfastness in the face of opposition, for sure. I mean, I'm not going to deny myself that. But I am the first to hear what I say or what is said through me. I can completely understand how people get the perception that they're speaking for some consciousness or force outside and larger than themselves. My unconscious generates and spits up ideas, conversations, arguments, perspectives, proofs, and rebuttals. Like manic bicyclists whose legs never tire. You know, so many people have enjoyed Paul McCartney's song Yesterday, but Paul McCartney was the first to hear that song. He dreamt of the melody in a dream, and he wrote down nonsense lyrics, scrambled eggs, oh my dear, you have got lovely legs. And then he played the melody to everyone like, you've heard this before, and people are like, no. So he wrote down the lyrics. He was the first to hear the song. The song came through him. Paul McCartney is the flesh mechanism by which the gods of music release their beauty to the world. And I, to some degree, am the flesh mechanism by which the gods of philosophy release truth and virtue to the world. And I say this, this may sound arrogant, it's really not. It's actually quite the opposite. I am incredibly lucky to have the accidental brain that I have. And I've always felt this weight, this obligation. And I'm very glad that I accepted that weight and that obligation. I am a good writer of fiction, and I always felt that it was my job as a writer of fiction to promote as much peace, reason, and virtue in the world, which is why I have, in a novel that I wrote in my 20s, in Just Poor, I have a scene where two courageous people confront a child abuser. Because that's what I wanted and that's what the world should do. I've always felt that I need to shape the creative forces of my mind to maximize the universals of virtue within the world. And it is with great humility that I sit down to talk about these things. It's not the me that I know. The me that I know are the things that I choose, right? My identity are the things that I choose. I obviously do not choose the brain that I have. I do not choose the thoughts that arise within me. They arise within me. It's an old thing that Leonard Cohen said. He says, well, where did you get such beautiful songs, right? And he said, I don't know. If I knew where I got these beautiful songs, I would go back there and get more. And Bob Dylan also says, in an interview where he says, I can't do that stuff anymore. He who is not busy living is busy dying. I can't do that stuff anymore. It's other things I can do, but I can't do that. And the humility of recognizing that there is a force beneath or beyond you that uses you, hopefully, to spread virtue. Sometimes it's used to spread corruption. But the humility of that is a very powerful thing. And a lot of what I have done in the world and over the course of my life has been to avoid looking back and say, I wasted the greatest gift a man can get. I can't tell you, that would be hell. That would be hell. To be older and to say, for myself, I was given the greatest gift a human being can get, which is the spontaneous generation of moral universals. There is no greater gift. If I had ignored that gift, if I had deprecated that gift, if I had tried to twist it to personal advantage, if I had not, as simply and honestly and directly as possible, spoken the universals that move through me, the amount of regret that would have plagued me would be beyond the capacity of language to express. It is a deep and sinister sorrow to underachieve in the face of your potential. And in particular, because I have both an artistic side, a philosophical side, and a moral side, and I'm a good communicator, and I'm fantastic with analogies and metaphors. To not use that to maximize the production and transmission of universal virtue in the world. It would be like having a healing hand and spending your whole life avoiding hospitals in pursuit of winning at poker. It's not mine. It's mankind's. Seeing some of the regret that hits people later in life. What was it? Even Leonardo da Vinci said that he regretted enormously the poor use he had given to the gifts he received. Try not to let your days pass by in a haze of the now. What am I going to have for lunch? Somebody said something mean in an email. The girl won't go out with me. These are detritus and particulates in the haze of the now. And I'm not saying live in a complete abstraction of otherworldliness, but remind yourself daily to partake of eternity. Create something that lasts, even if it is an idea in someone else's mind that can then be further transmitted. Speak a truth. Deny a lie. Do something where your transitory, rotting flesh can create something in the sky that lasts forever. It could be an act of kindness that turns someone's life around. It could be an act of firmness that pulls someone out of self-delusion. It could be any act of depth and danger and moment and power. Try never to deny yourself the capacity to partake of eternity. And this could be, of course, the having and raising of children, which is part of an eternal line that goes back 4 billion years. All of your fears will fade. And the fears that you use to avoid regret, the fears will fade. And you will be looking back, not remembering why you were scared, but only that you did not achieve. You did not touch the face of God and partake of eternity. It was something deep and meaningful. Not the provocation of envy by trying to look cool and good. Not the amassing of wealth that is cold, empty comfort as you age. I look at all of the fitness bros on social media, and of course, this is an old statement, but if you had worked on the quality of your soul half as much as you had worked on the quality of your flesh, you would be a god among men. I look forward every day to planting a flag in uncertain ground that I now am certain will fly forever. If that's too abstract, I look at saying things that are true, that will be recognized as true 1,000 or 1,000,000 years from now. Think of Pythagoras. We still use his name on the geometry theorem. He partook of eternity. To partake of eternity is powerful enough, but to partake of moral eternity and moral universals and moral absolutes, what I speak is incomprehensible and alienating to most. I get that. But in the future, it will be incomprehensible that anyone thought differently. And that is to partake of eternity. The proofs of UPB were true, will always be true, everywhere, forever and ever. Amen. And what is the thought of death? It is that we will be released from this veil of tears, and we will partake of a blissful eternity. Heaven is the truths we speak that remain after we die. And I hope that my words sound as a kind of shivery bell to dislodge your anxieties and your fears from your soul, to partake of the eternal, to partake of the virtuous, not of the greedy, not of the manipulative, not of the transient, not of the sycophantic, not of the mere material advantage, not of the provocation of envy or lust, but to partake of eternity by speaking simple truths to the world is the greatest use of the accidental inheritance of a mind. You and I did not earn becoming human. We did not earn our minds. We did not earn our inspirations. And that which is not earned must not be consumed, but rather invested. If you inherit $10 million, you don't just spend it on Menendez nonsense, cars and watches, right? You inherit $10 million, you invest it. You didn't earn it, so you must invest it. You can't just consume it for your own benefit. And there's no greater inheritance than the human mind that is. No greater inheritance. The entire world's wealth is worth less than one human mind, because there's no wealth without human minds. And when you approach people with the clarity of expressive depth, absolutely, some people will part before you, and they will flee. They will flee. But there were other people who will view your depth as a deep well to be drunk from during a time of near universal shallowness. What is it that the shallowness of hatred, the shallowness of bigotry, the shallowness of greed, the shallowness of lust, all of this is presented to you as a distraction from your infinite potential. Infinite potential. Do not deny your infinite potential. As I always, always beg you, do not deny your infinite potential, or regret will be the only bitter meal you taste for the last 20 years of your life. Because there comes a time where you can't go back, right? If you don't have depth, then you get embedded in relationships reliant upon your shallowness, right? You end up embedded in relationships that rely on your shallowness. And then what happens is you have to stay shallow in order to pretend to have company, to have companions, right? There is, to me, a very good bit, you could say, in my novel, The Present. And it is about the presence of depth in a shallow environment, the sudden presence of depth in a shallow environment. I'm going to read you this little bit. And if you haven't read my novel, The Present, or listened to it in audiobook, I think you really should. It's really, really good. Rachel goes from shallowness to depth over the course of a fairly brutal story. Let me just see if I can find it. I will find it. I think it's in chapter one. Yes, a sudden fissure of unanticipated depth cracked open within her. Ah, I remember the word I'm looking for. Zoom, there we go. So something real happens. A real powerful question happens in a restaurant that everyone hears. And here's what I wrote about this. A supernatural silence had swallowed up the restaurant. A brief glimpse to a wider world, to reality, in fact, had cracked open the petty cathedral of distraction everyone hid in. Inconsequential differences, imaginary slights, silly details of graying hair, spiky moles and acne scars, minor debts and hangnails, the anger at food served slightly cold, invitations delayed and the petty rejection of 3 nights prior, all these detritus details and dust vanished in a sudden interstellar zoom out. A minor but powerful presage of the deathbed regrets that put everything in perspective far too late. Hearing about volatile toddlers being pulled from daycare put a chill down the spines of the droning corporate females who wrestled with slides and spreadsheets for impatient and indifferent men the true patriarchy of indoctrinated wage slavery, as they rushed to placate the bosses who always rolled their eyes at tales of sick children, the same bosses who would inevitably fade from their lives like the drunken siren of a racing ambulance into the deep rear mirrors of paychecks long gone. And a skylight suddenly shattered over that very deathbed they would all face, if they're lucky, where the empty boss gods they sacrifice their children to are distant or dead, and they reach out for their grown children, who find themselves distracted and busy. And all the lost and fossilized spreadsheets and presentations that they sold their future for will never be unearthed, never be reviewed. They have as much value to the future as the dead diapers of infancy. And all their decades of ambition, postponement and conformity, and chasing dollars to swell their taxes are all flushed into nothing, while all the seeds of love that should have been planted in the fertile hearts of babies are handed to bosses to be consumed and destroyed. And all of this is hinted and revealed in the moments of perspective that strike and scald the oceans of distraction like kindly heaven-sent comets. People listen or recoil. Time moves on regardless, and all is revealed before the end. Perspective is inevitable. Morality is inescapable. The glory of the universe is the finger tapping on the shoulder of conscience delivered on a regular but declining basis. Until souls either listen and live, or... And of course we all know what happens to Rachel in that chapter. All right, let's get to your questions again. Sorry, I'm a little behind here. A little behind in your comments. All right. Seems like all the dysfunction in this generation's parents gets blamed on men and the oppression of women, not letting them go into the workforce, always a psyop preloaded to trick the next generation. Yeah, I think so. Somebody says, doesn't matter who wins elections if all roads lead to more money printing, the US debt will be 50 trillion plus by 2030. No one can stop it. Well, math will stop it eventually, right? Why would anyone use a deflationary currency like Bitcoin to buy stuff when the stuff will depreciate and the currency will not? That's why most people just hoard it. Yeah. See, and Paul McCartney was 22 when he wrote Yesterday. Most 22-year-olds don't even have a bank account. Right. Now, he prepared himself to write that song, right, with the 10,000 hours of the Berlin nightclub and so on. But he didn't write Yesterday. He just wrote it down. He experienced the song in a dream and then just wrote it down. I mean, if he could write it, he would write more, right? When was the last time he had a top 10 hit? Right, he's been still productive. He's still producing, right? All right. For your information, Venmo is not available in Kanakistan, but PayPal is. Maybe they will allow Bitcoin transactions, yeah. Rush Limbaugh nailed it. He said, feminism is for ugly women. I will say ugly personality possessing women. If I am kind, I would attribute it to trauma. Feminism was a necessary ideology to permit the exploitation of men. Let's see here. It's difficult to have sympathy for women who had every great possibility handed to them and still managed to blow it. Then again, I may not have done much better in their position. Well, it's the old question of, does the average person have enough free will to resist propaganda, right? The Milgram experiments show that about 80% of people will torture and some will even kill people if someone in authority tells them to. And that's similar, of course, to the number of people who took the vaccine. So the fact that I remember when I read that Milgram experiment, right, and it's been reproduced in many different areas and locations, to 70%, 75%, 80% of people will just do what anyone in authority tells them to. And of course, the great danger, they're the greatest danger in the world. And I remember when I read that, that would be such a shocking result, and nobody predicted that it would be that high. I mean, a lot of psychologists thought it would just be in the single-digit percentage of sociopaths and psychopaths and narcissists and so on. But I don't think anyone guessed that it would be 70 to 80% of people will just torture and some will even kill based upon someone in authority telling them to do so. And not even the experiment must continue, not you have to, right? And people will just, they've completely externalized their conscience to authority figures, right? Now, of course, we understand why that would evolve and what the consequences of not evolving that way were, which were usually fatal. But I remember when I first read that, I was like, well, shouldn't all society be reformed? Like, shouldn't we just do massive research into figuring out why that's the case and then just find some absolute way to lower those numbers no matter what? But no, it just kind of came and went as usual, right? Because it serves too much interest, right? Somebody says, I would like to be wealthy enough to own at least a two-bedroom condo and a working truck, having someone to share it with. I want to create my own small business. Yeah, I'm not saying don't, like, wealth is unimportant, don't pursue wealth. I'm not saying that at all. I'm just saying that, I mean, to be completely indifferent to wealth is not healthy. To view wealth as a substitute for virtue is not healthy, right? Seems like there's parallels with the fate of the founding fathers and the disciples of Jesus. Well, of course, and all who progress are, all who push progression, particularly moral progression, are absolutely attacked, for sure. People get great profit from delusion, and delusion combined with the coercive power of the state is an entire ecosystem that resists any liberation, right? I mean, the guys who owned slaves weren't particularly happy with the abolitionists, right? Somebody says, I approached a man whose child was having a panic attack. The man explained that the boy had recently been attacked by a giant snake that hides in sandpits to hunt. The child was terrified because he just spotted a nearby sandpit. The man, fixated on the sandpit, began throwing pebbles at it, hoping to lure out the snake. When he focused on that, I noticed another sandpit just beside him, the one he hadn't seen. I quickly realized the second pit was the real threat, and I could make out I don't know what happened to the rest of that story. B2B is huge. Companies spend a lot of money on equipment, tools, software. Oh, yeah, it's huge. Oh, you can make out the outline of a giant snake below the surface. I'm not quite sure what the point of that story is. Do you think video games will recover? The woke stuff is extreme and nothing original is being made. Seems like the companies are playing it safe and remaking their old games. I mean, in a sense, it's a self-healing phenomenon. There are too many men who, and women, of course, but mostly men, who get too much of a sense of artificial achievement from video games, right? So whatever you put a lot of money into in a status society, whatever you put a lot of money into will attract power mongers and become corrupted. So. The Lightning Network, although it has its flaws. Yeah, I understand that. Yeah. And you know, as I said, wherever there's a big enough demand, there will be a solution. It looks like B2B is about 2 to 3 times bigger than the business to consumer. Right. So think of, and the way to understand B2B and thus understand the value of Bitcoin in this way is what you do is you go to the grocery store and you look at a can of tuna, right? and you go pay a couple of bucks for that can of tuna, and think of all of the equipment and money and spending that businesses had to do in order to get that tuna from the coast of Japan or wherever into a tin and into your hand, right? So think of all of the fishing, the labor, the trucks, the insurance, the airplanes, the gas. Like, think of all of the massive amount of economic activity that had to occur in order for you to be able to hold a can of tuna and pay a couple of bucks for it, right? It's the amount of, I mean, obviously the amount of financial investment has to be less than what you're paying for it, but it's huge. It's huge. Hug those wonderful ladies in your family on our behalf, if you don't mind. I do not mind. Got a lovely hug this morning from my daughter. Just beautiful. All right. Adopted. Let's see here. Adopted mom's dad had dementia from the mid-80s. He lived to 94. His mind was gone years before. That was horrific to witness. Yeah. Steph, I don't want to see you old and decrepit. Thank you for working out. Well, but I will be old and decrepit. It's just, I mean, you can push it off, but you can't eliminate it. Somebody says, I just now, or this morning, lying in bed, I got a personal revelation of the true power that faith and the priesthood hold to as the savior and to literally move mountains. I'm not there yet, but I glimpsed the merest possibility. Beautiful word, Steph. I'm reminded of a quote I dug up recently. Everything you've ever wanted is on the other side of fear. Yeah, so what do we fear? We fear losing, but we're going to lose everything anyway. We're going to lose everything anyway. The present and the future are amazing. I re-listen to them about every 3 to 4 months. If you all haven't read them, I don't know what you're doing. Yeah, I think so. Okay, I listen, but I must get dressed for church. Fair. The snake pit was a dream the bot says you never wrote about. Someone was asking the meaning of... Oh, okay, that's what it is. Okay, got it. It was interesting to see how the post-communist countries had a significantly lower vaccination rate than the Western countries. Oh, it's interesting. I went on a date with a woman yesterday who spoke loudly, no inside voice, and she invited me to her house, and I saw her meds sitting on the kitchen table. She was prescribed Seroquel, the antipsychotic, as a sleep aid, and clonazepam for anxiety. I feel the need to explain to her that she needs to get off these meds because she won't have a brain in 2 years. I can't give you any advice about that. I'm not a doctor. I'm quite glad video games have become woke, or shit in general. It makes playing them far less tempting for me, which is fantastic. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I like the older games. I'll still occasionally boot up Unreal Tournament 3, play some Warfare. It's great. All right. Any other last questions, comments? Thank you for your tips, my friend. Sunday offering. Thank you. I very much appreciate that. Let me just go and check over here. Let's see here. Somebody says, Rose says, the love of money is the root of all evil, not just money, which is just a tool. It is the love of money, like thinking it will save you when there are times no amount of money will help a situation. Yeah, for sure. For sure. Everything that is centralized and coercive becomes corrupted. Right. All right. Well, I really do appreciate you guys coming by today. Thank you so, so much. Lots of love from up here. Have yourself a wonderful week. I will see you on Wednesday. I look forward to producing the new shows. You can, of course, get a call-in. Happy to take call-ins. You can go to freedomain.com/call-in, and you can choose public or private as you see fit. And I always look forward to chatting with people about what's going on in their lives and how philosophy can help. And I thank you, thank you, thank you for the great gift of this absolutely amazing conversation. And I really, really deeply and humbly appreciate it. And again, sorry for my snappiness last Wednesday, but it's all better. Thanks, everyone. Bye.